Hey, okay, so this is different than what we normally do, and don't worry, you'll still get the regular pop culture headlines later, but we've got something super special for you today. Sideshow's celebrating their Monsters vs. Villains event, and there was recently a discussion amongst friends at Sideshow headquarters. See, Ryan Turek, the VP of Development at Blumhouse Productions, hosted an interview with actor, producer, and comic book writer David Dalsmalchian, screenwriter and producer Akela Cooper, and Sideshow chief creative officer Tom Gilliland. They all got together and discussed their love of monsters. The full video of this is on Sideshow's YouTube channel. And if you appreciate this type of special episode on the Pop Culture Headlines podcast, let us know. Email us at podcasts@sideshow.com. For now, enjoy, and don't forget to tell your friends.
All of like your slasher heroes, there's a relentless quality to them that to me goes back to, again, my personal feelings of like, when will this shit leave me alone? Yeah. When will I not feel like, when can it just go away?
That was David Dalsmalchian, and here's Ryan Turek introducing the theme of this episode.
Fandom is something that you dedicate your heart to. It's unique, deeply personal. And I'm here joined by three friends who all share a similar passion. We're here for the love of monsters. I'm so glad that I'm joined by all of you to discuss one of my favorite topics. I'm sure like all of you, we all have our own favorite subgenres of horror. Slasher sits up there with me. Monsters rides right alongside it. We all come from different walks of career life, you know, screenwriter, you're over here at Sideshow doing amazing work.
Making magic.
Making cool stuff. Actor, writer, producer, David, you know. But we all have that kind of similar origin story in a way. There was always that one monster movie that clicked for us. Akela, you're more excited about this. Let's dive in.
I want to know
what that first monster movie was for you.
Again, this is Akela Cooper.
So you'll have to talk to my mom about this, but like I had two parents who basically just let us see what they saw.
Yeah.
So I saw R-rated and inappropriate probably for age range movies early on. Like my dad loved John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah.
I would watch The Thing with my dad. But there was one movie in particular that my parents had seen in our small little local theater, and they came home raving about it. And my brother, who is 5 years older than me, so he was like 13, I think, at the time, and I was like 7 or 8. They were like, we just saw this really great movie. It's called Pumpkinhead.
Nice.
And it's so good, and it's got like Lance Henriksen, and he was in Aliens and blah, 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 blah. And my brother and his friends were like, well, we want to go. And my parents were like, yeah, we'll take you to see it again. And I'm just like listening to this, and I was like, I want to go. It's like, you're talking about how good it is. I'd like to see it. And it's like, no, you cannot see this. Like, they understood. It's like, you cannot see this. And I'm like, oh, man. So they were leaving me at my grandmother's house.
Oh, man.
And my grandmother and I were standing in like the screen door, and like we were waving, and I see the car pull away, and then the car stops. It backs up. And my brother comes out, and he comes up to the door. He's like, come on.
Yes.
And for what a
like,
champ.
For like years, I did not know what changed. And then finally, like a couple of years ago, I asked my mom, I'm like, what made you guys turn back around? And she said, I saw you in the rearview mirror.
Oh.
And you look so sad at being left out that I couldn't leave you. So we all go to see Pumpkinhead.
Yeah.
And if you've seen this movie, you know the opening. It's like, it's an incredibly scary cold open where you actually one of the few where you get a full-on shot of the monster from the beginning.
That's right.
I see this, and my parents were right. I end up in my mom's lap, like, watching the movie, like, kind of from her armpit, where, like, when it wasn't scary, I would be watching, and then when you got into the meat of the movie, you had the auditory sound of, like, the cicadas mm-hmm. that would accompany it. It's like, so when I heard that sound, I was like, here he comes. And I was like, yep, just ducked back under her armpit. But there were glimpses I caught, and, like, they bought that movie, and, like, they would watch it. Like, my dad would watch The Thing years later, and so just as they kept watching it, I had nightmares. Like, I had to sleep in my parents' bed after
wow.
that initial screening for, like, a week
wow.
because it affected my psyche so deeply.
But worth it.
Very much so worth it. Like, I love that monster now. And it's like, that is the archetype I look to for like monster design, and like RIP Stan Winston, who was my monster hero for the longest time. But that is my iconic monster.
Yeah, yeah. It's so funny when you mention cicadas, because I attribute, after I saw Predator,
My dad took me to go see Predator opening night, and Predator made that weird clicking noise from the trees. And crows make that noise too. So I remember the next day running around my neighborhood, and I would hear the crows up on the up on the telephone poles, and I'd be like, "Predator's here!
Yes,
Predator's here!" Tom, what about you? What was your first?
So you know, I grew up in Burbank, in the down in the horse territory. So my dad, big into the old black and whites and whatnot. So this would be the early 70s. So the movie Them,
Giant
Ants. But the thing is, so where the Burbank part comes in is because, if I'm not mistaken, they filmed the whole end sequences in the sort of the LA River Basin Wash down there. That's right there at Griffith Park. I mean, we were literally two blocks from here. So aside from, you know, watching this with my dad, who, you know, throughout, you know, the movie's kind of a slow burn, you know. So I was like, well, what's that sound? What's that sound? What's that? And, you know, my dad's like, watch the movie, watch the movie. And so, you know, we get to the end, and of course, this is literally happening two blocks from our house. And I'm like, we go down in here and play all the time. And this is exactly the plot with the kids getting, you know, abducted by these ants. Anyway, it was about 10 years ago, I remember, you know, hauling this out, showing it to my own kids, and the exact same line fired out of my mouth from my dad. Just watch the movie. And I was like, oh, this is so complete circle. And I think from there, it was just the association of monsters with things that had some relevance to my locale. So whether it became, you know, from there, you know, Jaws and sharks and Bigfoot in the forest and every other thing that I started to associate and draw mythology or fantasy into real life. And I think that's kind of where it's just stayed for me. So
that's great.
Films like that did it.
And it's fun, it must have been fun growing up in that area, because I'm sure you identified other locations that you attributed to, like, it came from another world and stuff like that. I mean, I didn't even know, driving through that area, I was like, oh, that's where the spaceship landed in this movie, you know?
Well, you know, and that's a gift that keeps on giving, because as, you know, you get older and older, and, you know, certainly when I started driving and getting around places, I was like, oh, hey.
Any Planet of the Apes fans, you go to Malibu
Canyon. Oh, yeah, I've done that one, too.
It's wild.
And convince the kids that they were still out here somewhere.
Yes. Speaking of, so, like, after you saw them, when you went back to the basin to play, were you and your friends like?
Oh, it was, I mean, it was like, okay, yeah, we know. No, it's not. But, you know, with the imaginations of kids being what it is, it was like, well, let's just steer into this and let's just play that. So now we're down there looking for ants and daring each other how far we're going to go down this dark corridor into this thing. Much to my mom's, you know, no doubt, you know, discomfort blocks away. Which she didn't know was definitely good for her. So
those were always the play places, too. It's so weird, like the storm drainage ditches. I grew up in Kansas, and that was like, there were parks. There were basketball courts nearby. There was a pool. But no, we were in the ditch.
Let's play in the
ditch. Let's go in the ditch,
Well, this feels like what's missing somewhat, or I don't know, maybe that was just the, you know, glory of the 70s, 80s, whatever. It was like, you know, you could go do these things. So these horror movie plot points were so, like, relatable.
They were.
Like, we do this all the time. Of course.
David Dusmalchin jumps in.
Well, speaking of relatable, I guess, for me, it was the thing tickling the whatever that, like, got me hooked. I'm, like, very young, and I grew up in a house where movie monsters and literary monsters were not embraced. Although, in my opinion, looking back, there was other monsters that I was like, boy, that was much scarier than the movie monsters. But very conservative household, very you know, we don't dabble with dark things was kind of the mentality. So I wanted to dabble. So I,
the
rebellious kid in me, who also, you know, there was so much unspoken monstrosity in our household. We, you know, I have a grandfather who was severely mentally ill, and the way that that was addressed, or seeing the different types of behaviors and personalities that erupted, were just all these things in that, you know, early mid 80s America, conflicting messages. And here I was, you know, feeling very guilty about the fact that I was so tempted, watching afternoon cartoons after school on KSHB TV 41 in Kansas City. There would be this little teaser at the end of the commercials and go, Friday night, tune in to Cremation Mortem's Friday Nightmare. So I waited until everyone's asleep on a Friday night, and I, like, tiptoe downstairs and get the pink blanket. I can remember all of it so vividly in the dark of the basement, which my dad had like carpeted and put wood paneling. It was like, It was its own scary set. and watching Cremation Mortem, who was our local horror host, who I was immediately like, like, I had feelings for Cremation. But she was warm and kind and loving and funny. She was so funny. And she was playing Curse of the Werewolf. Mm. Ooh, okay. Werewolves are a monster for me that are probably at the highest of my everything when I think, you know, if I had to choose, someone said, what's your favorite monster? Because I have so many favorite monsters. Mm. But watching this man transform into this story was very dramatic and it was emotional, and the world in there, like that period world that was created, and then the transformation, all of it erupted something in me that I've never recovered from. Yeah. And I was crying as a kid, both scared and I think moved by how sad that story is too.
Right,
so that's probably where it all started. Although every other thing, Scooby-Doo and Halloween and Monster Mash and
that was the thing.
All
was
that stuff.
I reflected on this question, but there were so many, like you, there was like, I had a household, you know, that sometimes would skirt danger by going, come see this horror movie, or they would leave HBO on, mm-hmm. and suddenly I'm exposed to Cujo, and I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah.
This is terrifying. But I think it really, for me, it goes back to Godzilla. Because when I was 3 or 4, there was that giant green Godzilla toy with the fist that fires out of his arm.
And then was there a fire spit?
There was a fire spit.
Yes, yeah.
And it was. And now you go to Comic-Con and you're like, oh, it's $5,000.
Yes, it is.
And I would abuse the heck out of this thing. He would fly through the air. I'd throw him across the yard, throw his fist at my sister. Sorry, Robin. But, you know, it really goes back to Godzilla because it was the first monster I became friends with. Mm-hmm. And I realized that I can be friends with these things that are dangerous. And it wasn't until I got older and started getting exposed to, it was probably Stephen King's Cycle of the Werewolf, which really clicked in because my dad was a big book collector and he had the original Cycle of the Werewolf. Mm-hmm. Sitting on the you know, those 1970s giant speakers that everybody would have in their household. And I remember opening the page and it was a picture of a werewolf reaching through a car window, tearing a cop's face off.
Yep.
And I was like, That's awesome. I don't know what that is, but that's really cool. And then I attempted to read it and it didn't instantly click in, but you know, the next day when I went to elementary school, I was drawing, you know, mm-hmm. drawing what that werewolf was in my mind.
Was your teacher like, Ryan?
Yes,
we need to talk.
Yeah.
100%.
Is your mother coming to get you today?
100%. Yeah, it was, but it was, you know, it was Godzilla followed by the kind of door the Cycle of the Werewolf opened. And once my dad kind of discovered my fascination with it, then he was like, let me educate you properly here and show you Frankenstein, Dracula, the Wolfman, all of the, you know, universal and classics.
The big pantheon.
Like, talking about Godzilla, who is kind of the first, is like, it's presented as a monster, it's presented as the threat that kills a lot of people that you should fear and run from, who then becomes cool.
Yeah.
And like, a lot of horror movie monsters have that transition, like start a villain, and then if you make it long enough, you become cool. Like Freddy, Jason, Michael Myers.
Yeah. People like, the monster.
I remember going to see the new Halloween from Blumhouse, and like the moment when Michael opens the trunk and puts on a mask, Arclight Hollywood, RIP to that. Yeah. Everybody lost their shit. Yeah. I lost my shit. I was like, yeah. And then I'm like, wait, no.
No. He's going to kill people.
I know. Why are we cheering this? It's like, but he's cool now. And like, it's on the t-shirts, it's the toys, it's the lunchboxes.
Right. That is a fantastic observation. I mean, like, I didn't even think about it that mm-hmm. way because, like, for me, I had to embrace, there was like, as a fan, I had to, like, step through the process. Freddy Krueger terrified me.
Yes.
Terrified me. The Blob 88. Which I was probably old enough to know better that it wasn't real. I had nightmares because what Chuck Russell and Frank Darabont, that whole team, makeup effects team, did is bring a realism to what the Blob could do to you. Mm-hmm. So when
it was so gross.
It was so gross. Yeah. So when he walked in and he peeled the girl off the floor, I was like, no, I never want to have that happen to me. And I had nightmares for it. I don't think the Blob ever became a hero for me, but I was like trying to like just absorb, like draw it and mm-hmm. like understand it, because if I understood it, then it takes hero status.
Yeah.
You know? How do you think, how do you think that the fandom for Monsters has evolved as we've gotten older? I've been reflecting on this now creeping towards 50, thinking about these kinds of things. It's like, what do Monsters mean to me? I'm still deeply fascinated and I still get super excited about them. But has anything changed in your perception?
Tom Gilliland answers first.
There's a lot of categories, which is interesting. So it was once, like, perhaps maybe a good way to put it, it was a library with one giant encyclopedia. But now it's become the entire set. Yeah, so, mm-hmm. you know, in terms of subgenres or everything else, so whether you're watching, you know, Godzilla or the, you know, sort of big epic monsters to, you know, all the way other end of things to serial killers and everything else, it's like, wow, that is just... And I think the thing that's nice about it, too, is you're not... in for a penny, in for a pound, you could go wherever you want. And mm-hmm. I think that's the interesting part, is everybody's got something, because at the end of it is that underpinning of what did or didn't scare you, affect you, or otherwise. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be like, okay, we can all gravitate to different things. And, you know, as you tell Pumpkinhead, I'm like, okay, I was a little older then, so I saw it as more of a neat kind of creature movie. And, you know, and so it was like, oh yeah, no, I can see all the scares that, you know. But I think that's the fun part, is I can be drawn back to 8-year-old me, 13-year-old me, 20-year-old me, anywhere along the line, depending on where the movie sits in sort of the genealogy, right?
Yes, makes sense.
It's changed with me because I can afford more things.
Certainly that.
But I would say, like,
that is dangerous.
Pop culturally, yeah. my observation, I think about this a lot, is when I recognized that I was entering into like supreme fandom, which probably like late teen, maybe teen, just teens, where I was hiding Fango under my mattress, mm-hmm. or I was trying to get to see all the things that were forbidden and digging back into everything, you know. I feel like it was a certain space. Now, and this is a good thing, over time, the heroization of some of the monsters, like you were just saying. So now there are pop culture icons, yeah. oddly, that represent murder and mayhem, but I kind of love that yes. because it's
the destruction of entire cities.
We're embracing our fears of things, yes. and we can, you know, I think that's what that's. I don't think it's some sick way of us all acting out our homicidal tendencies. I think it's no. us getting
speak
to
speak for yourself.
Okay, well, there's 3% according to the psychiatrist, but I think the 97% of us is cheering in those things are cheering because we're together and we survived and we're okay. And this thing that represents so much that we've feared for mm-hmm. so long, even since childhood, is still fun and not as scary. But there's another thing that's really cool with the younger generation I'm observing, because I'm aware of that group as well as the professional chauffeur of a 6 and 9-year-old. And chef.
Yeah.
Sometimes chef. And by chef, I mean drive-thru. You're welcome, kids. You're welcome. Yes, I own a bed and breakfast for a 6 and 9-year-old. And co-owned by my wife, and we observe there is a normalization in a good way of both iconic monsters and the new monsters, and this is it goes both directions, but I think it goes to, there's this great quote from a lot of great quotes that I'm not going to misquote here, but Emile Ferris is one of my favorite writers, and she says, you know, in life there's good monsters, there's bad monsters, and I'm seeing a lot of the content and the worlds that my kids are exploring mm-hmm. for that fandom, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and it's really fun seeing them embrace monsters that Frankenstein's monster we've always known was a tragic figure mm-hmm. yep. who was exploited and who really was just, and so seeing now there's so many different cartoons and toys revolving around that figure with different genders and different identities, but still that symbolic figure as something that the kids really look at in a totally different lens than we did or do.
Yeah.
I think that's cool.
Well, I was going to say, too, just in terms of the evolution of monsters, it's, you know, we, generationally speaking, you know, the Universal monsters quickly became playthings and quickly became action figures. Are there any contemporary movie monsters or even literary monsters and beyond that you still think have and hold a lot of power? I have my own thoughts, but I'm curious to hear yours of, like, that still resonate or scare. Like, for instance, I think the Cloverfield monster is mm-hmm. highly effective, and one of the reasons why it's highly effective is because of the way that movie was portrayed through that kind of found footage lens. I still get chills watching that movie when they go rushing into the bodega and they see on the television screen just the monster stomping around from a helicopter POV. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that is if I was to watch a giant monster rampage through the city, that's probably how I would see it. But are there any contemporary movie monsters that that have yet to become kind of diluted by action figures and merchandise and stuff that still resonate?
One of my favorites from the early 80s was Q, the Winged Serpent.
Larry Cohen.
Wow.
Yeah. Saw that with my dad. He rented it one day. We're going to watch this. And I thought it was cool. It's like a Winged Serpent. Like, and it's done. It's a very 70s movie, even though it was, I think it's like 1980, 81. But that one, I think it's like, it's just kind of like sitting there waiting to be rediscovered by people. And I'm not like a huge fan of like, let's remake everything. But like that probably deserves an update just because we have the technology now to like make that look so much better.
Yes.
So yeah, that's one that I would like to see like make a resurgence in pop culture.
My favorite scene of that movie is when the guy is just doing push-ups. There's somebody doing push-ups on the top of
and she's just counting board.
She's counting board, 99. And then Q just comes in and chomp. So good.
It's amazing that no one sees this big-ass thing flying around New York City.
He's always blocking the sun. He's like, I can't see it. Tom, what about you?
You know, I don't know. It's tough. I think by virtue of the sort of lens of Sideshow and us sort of, you know, drawing things out of the past all the time, I'm kind of caught in that cyclic loop. So I guess the thing, and it kind of comes to what you're saying, is the notion of like some of the older things getting new life, certainly through whether it's a Cloverfield, you know, mechanism or another way to kind of show the story that's a little bit more in line with the way everything else kind of comes to the younger folks. So, I mean, my kids are now 20 and 22, but they won't watch most of these old movies because they can't kind of get past, you know, they've never seen anything that wasn't CGI,
right,
essentially,
yeah,
or the lion's share of it. So when they see these older, clunkier effects, it just removes their suspension of disbelief kind of immediately. And so I think that probably, in a good way, a lot of this can revitalize itself through, you know, not just remakes, but reimaginations, which there's a lot of that, you know, going on in many interesting ways.
Yeah.
You know, CGI used to be just the provenance of giant blockbuster films, but now it's, you know, sort of accessible to productions of almost any size.
Yeah.
And I think, wow, the ways that it is, you know, cleverly manipulated, especially at the smaller levels, is just showing how much potency this power can be in the hands of people who really understand the genre.
Yeah.
It's tough because I'm not scared by a ton right now.
Yeah.
And I love so much of what's happening in horror, but from my middle-aged version of myself, which still loves sitting in the dark and the mise-en-scene and the score and the monsters brought to life. But I'm looking at it through this totally different lens now where I'm absorbing and experiencing this without screaming or jumping or et cetera, et cetera. I would say probably thinking about what hasn't made it onto the shelves at, you know, the back of the electronic section at Target yet in specialty packaging.
That is a new section. They should just call it Geek Corner.
Yeah, I think they do. But that is, you know, I'd look at other countries, filmmakers that are breaking ground in ways that we maybe lost track of or that are still utterly horrifying, like the Anwar, like Satan's Slave, that kind of monstrous horror from that. I feel like if that was in my backyard, like that shit would scare the fuck out of me.
That was like even The Ritual. Remember The Ritual of David Bruckner?
Yeah.
That thing that comes out on all fours and you realize it's
the
just
giant deer?
The giant deer,
yes.
But it's really just a human upside down
or
something.
Ooh.
What about, you know, what's it called? With the bear monster at the end, that would be one that still hasn't been like, I can't believe I can't
Annihilation?
Think of it.
Yes!
That's a great monster, man.
Yes.
That takes elements of The Thing and elements of Jacob's Ladder and elements of like everything.
It's the voice.
Yes. Yeah, it's the voice.
It is her voice coming out of that bear in agony.
Gnarly.
That just hammers
that
at home.
That's a good one. Okay,
we got one.
That is
a good one. But it's interesting too because you bring up a good point about it's kind of like, I just want to kind of dial into the attributes of what makes a great movie monster because we see the Frankenstein monster, Dracula, Wolfman, even the Mummy, the Gill Man. We all have our favorites, but these are like long-lasting generational monsters that they're married to themes that are evergreen. And it's interesting because I always look back and I look at that little pocket, and then I look at our slasher craze, you know, like Leatherface, Michael Myers, Jason Voorhees, Pinhead, on and on. Those are another generational, like, kind of monster that comes up, and they last forever too. So what are these things that are keeping them going? Let's go back to the Universal monsters. What are the things that keep them going? Because we're surrounded, by the way,
by
this and a representation of the Gilman.
A few
familiar faces. But
Dracula, Gilman, the Frankenstein's monster, all brought to life. And this isn't a commercial. I'm just saying, literally, I'm a fan of what you guys do here. And I love and collect the stuff myself. Like, I've got the Christopher Lee Dracula, you know, sitting prominently in my living room at my house. And thankfully, my family at the Airbnb that I run with my wife allows us. It's a weird house. Let's just say that. There's Victor Mature standing with a big spear fighting a giant iguana on our wall. You've seen that. It's a 10-foot high mural. Yeah. But I would say to me, and this goes back to what I think I touched on earlier with the cremation story, is the werewolf is evergreen because for someone like me, who is an addict and who also has wrestled with like mental illness and that struggle and knows that that's genetic as well as, you know, it's all the things. So the werewolf, you could be attacked from the exterior, something can enter your bloodstream and it can change your physiology. Mm-hmm. The fact that you could inherit something, as we saw in Curse of the Werewolf, mm-hmm. you could be born with something because of that genetic mix-up. That is never not going to be scary for me at all the different steps of my life as just somebody who was trying to figure my way out in the world and going, what's wrong with me? Why can't I just be like a normal people? Why do I keep doing these really stupid things and behaving in ways that feel like they're out of control of myself? Why am I doing things that feel like I can't have normal relationships with people? And then ultimately now becoming a parent and going, oh my God, what have I potentially possibly passed down? That's terrifying. And then as I get older, I'm sure looking at the world around me and being like, oh my God, so many walking werewolves don't recognize that there is options other than silver bullets, by the way. If you're out there and you feel like a werewolf, trust me, there are options. It's not just a silver bullet. There is treatment. But that's the big thing to me, and the power of science that we don't yet understand. The fact that there is an orbiting satellite planet that we look at every night that conducts trillions of gallons of water every day on our planet. Who's to say what effect that could have on the iron in your blood?
Yeah.
You know?
I don't know, in terms of fixtures, I think the aspect of some monsters that have credible imperviousness. Mm. And I think I was introduced to this with definitely one of my favorites is Big Chap and Alien.
Mm.
So this is kind of the first time that there was no real answer to getting rid of the monster.
Yep.
You had to just leave.
Yeah.
That was, and blow the ship up.
Blow it out of the airlock.
Hopefully that worked. But so that sort of, you know, I think is certainly a fixture. I mean, you know, spawned innumerable, you know, things in its own lineage, but also satellites all around it. But I also, the thing about it too was that it was unlike anything I'd seen to that point. Too. So, I mean, just it was faceless, essentially. It had a mouth, but nothing else to identify with and everything else. And it was just always tucked up in the dark.
Yeah. You're always so used to eyes. Eyes, which
were
remotes.
And it's so, and yeah, there were always something. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the monsters, you know, in my youth were, you know, the Harryhausen ones or whatnot. Yeah. So in a way they were mythological, but kind of, they had character and whatnot.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
this was just hate in, you know, in the darkness out there, and there's nothing you could do about it. And if you even did, its blood was acid, so good luck with that. And, you know, and so it's like, what are you supposed to do?
Yeah.
And thankfully, even in that movie, they just explore, well, here's one. But then, you know, another one comes along and it's like, well, here's a bunch.
Yeah.
And we brought a bunch of Marines, possibly the guys most capable or people in this case, you know, to deal with the situation. And they get smoked right away, too.
Yeah.
So your whole sense of like, well, OK, now what are we supposed to do?
Right.
We brought our A game and we just got, you know, flushed down the toilet. Yeah. So
they got their asses kicked, man.
They're Cheetos, man.
Well, off of that, because like Aliens, like I do love Pumpkinhead. Aliens is my favorite movie of all time. Like I absolutely love that movie. I'd say for like from, you know, the original monsters to Freddy, Jason, all of them, it's either presence and or personality. Mm-hmm. Like there is something we either see ourselves in these monsters or they do something that makes us like them and endear us to them, which is easy to see with Freddy. Cause like you look at Nightmare on Elm Street, he's creepy and scary as fuck. Still, there's a presence there and there's an intelligence there. And then by the time you get to the third one, it's like, you're funny and I don't like that because I don't want to be laughing while you kill me. but even with the silent ones, like Jason, physically a presence. And there's something going on behind those eyes. And like when he gets his mask ripped off, you see a vulnerability there. Like he's scared for the first time. And it's like, oh, you poor drowned big boy. So there's always something. And I would say for like my two, like Pumpkinhead and the Queen Alien, when she was introduced, one of the things that absolutely terrified me as a child about those two is that like we're looking at them initially as animals. Like just, you know, we think of monsters as like these mindless lurking things. It's like, I'm gonna chase you and I'm gonna kill you. Pumpkinhead and the Queen Alien displayed intelligence, especially Pumpkinhead. Like one of my favorite moments in that movie is when the little Appalachian boy is hiding in Ed's closet with the dogs in the basket and whatnot, and he's behind the clothes and he thinks, I'm good. Pumpkinhead comes in, looks around, is like, huh, nobody here, I guess. Turns, stops, and then turns around and just like moves the clothes and is like in his face, like, I knew you were here. I saw that in the theater and I'm just like, he's smart. Oh no, I couldn't hide from him. I couldn't hide from it. The second thing in that movie that's a great moment is when, I think it's Jeff East, who's playing Chris, is walking. They see like the motorbike that's been left out. And he's like, we gotta get out of here. I'm gonna go to the motorbike. And he gets on the motorbike and he's trying to start it. And then you hear a scream and then boom, Pumpkinhead is there with the chain. Just doing this. And again, I'm like, oh shit, he set him up. Oh no. Like, oh no, like I can't, I'm not gonna get away from him. And then you get to Ripley meeting the Queen Alien and there's that exchange. It's like, I will fry your eggs if you don't leave me alone. And the Queen Alien looks to her little minions and is like, back off. There's communication happening. And then she fries her eggs anyways and just goes on a, you know, tear. And the Queen Alien is like, fuck this. I'm going after you. I'm going to get revenge for you killing my babies. It's like, whoa, wait, no. Like initially they were just like these mindless things in the first one. And then we get to the Queen, it's like, oh shit. She's gonna run you down. Not only is she gonna run you down, she's gonna be like, that ship is leaving. I'm hitching a ride.
Personality is everything. It's a delicate balance, especially in the field that we're in, making films, is just like, how much do you show? But sometimes I wanna get greedy and I wanna imbue some of these monsters with personality. Like one of the earliest memories I have is when King Kong beats the hell out of a monster. And then he's just like, flip, he starts playing with his jaw. Pumpkinhead, absolutely.
Stole that moment.
So good. You know, I mean, even like the little things like Critters, you know, where it's just like, should we run? I don't know. And then they get blasted and he's like, shit, we should run, you know? It's silly stuff like that, that you're just like, this is why I endear myself to these characters, because it's, you're injecting that personality. But at the same time, it's like, stay in the shadows. Be the descent monsters in the cave.
Don't show us everything. Don't be on stage in the spotlight, you know, singing, putting on the Ritz. Because then we go into another level of storytelling. Listening to what you were just saying, it made me spark a thought of, do you wonder if one of the motivators behind why we will continue to go see episodes 1 through 27 of whatever our favorite monster is that there is a horror in recognition of like the only thing more relentless than death is some of these figures too. They're so relentless, like Pumpkinhead's relentless. The Xenomorphs are relentless. All of like your slasher heroes are. There's a relentless quality to them that to me goes back to, again, my personal feelings of like, when will this shit leave me alone? When will I not feel, like, when can it just go away? You know, and that, and it's just always there. It's always coming. That It Follows did that really well. Where the monster was changing.
That helps kind of clarify my earlier kind of ghost monster point. Cause it's like the aspect of the notion of like, you know, that that impervious now is even beyond the grave. So, I mean, like, okay, I can't even escape by necessarily being killed, because this ghost is present in both realms, whatever. Mm. So,
yeah.
I think that aspect of, like, continually to stack the deck against you watching this in terms of just from your survival, options or what the odds might be. I think when they put some of that stuff in there, I always felt that, the ones that got me the most were the ones that I felt I had almost no ability to do anything about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's like, okay, cool. Put me in that point where it's just, you've taken every tool away from me, pulled the rug out from under me. And now what am I going to do?
Yeah.
And that's like, wow. That's probably the scariest part.
Yeah. And the other thing too is like going back to personality and nature, like watching the host monster, you're just watching Mother Nature play out. Like mm-hmm. that's that thing, yeah. That thing is not, doesn't have a malevolent, just motivation. It's just doing what it does. And that's why I also kind of love monster movies, because it's just watching their nature play out. Mm. Like the alien. Alien's just chilling. He's doing his thing. He's just going through his life cycle.
Yes.
Everybody's in the way. And that's what I love about the host, is like there's some really great photography of just seeing that thing swinging around, and you're just watching like a nature doc.
Sure.
And that's sometimes the best monster movies play out that way, like a nature doc.
The thing in the host also had displayed intelligence.
Yes.
Especially when you think the little girl is finally gonna get out of like that cave, whatever, and like she runs for it, and we're all like, yes, 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 and then whoop, and it's wrapped her up in its tail,
yes,
gently.
That's right, yeah.
Mind you, and it's just like,
bye.
I'm gonna put you back down.
Yeah,
you're not
like
going
Jaws
anywhere.
Fits in that box
that's
too.
When that movie got. Mm. I was like, oh fuck.
Yeah. Kayla, you mentioned Stan Winston being one of your favorite creature creators.
Yes.
Steve Wang is one of mine. You guys, do you have a fave?
Winston, Rick Baker,
Savini
guys.
I worked for Rick, so that's kind of sucks. So,
Rick?
Definitely,
tell
appreciate
him
the respect
hello.
Everything he did. Oh, I haven't seen him in a while, but I certainly will.
Whoops.
No, it's all good.
Shane and the guys who work at Legacy now, they all, broke their teeth under Stan, mm-hmm. I think, are mm-hmm. pushing all kinds of boundaries, and they're just so gifted. It's so exciting, but I still go back because I'm the actor at the table.
Sure.
My hero, the person who probably inspires me more than anybody when it comes to being the performer that I dream of being someday and like aspire to be, would be Lon Chaney.
Mm. Yeah.
The work that he was, and not that he didn't collaborate with other artists on some of the creature creations, but so much of the dedication to that. And that's why I'm always grateful for the years I spent in theater training and studying makeup artistry and kind of trying to understand the way you can manipulate the face before any post is done on it, trying to really capture stuff in camera. Because to me, if you're across the table from somebody and you're able to have that they can react to in the space, it's not just about me and my performance now, it's about you and your performance, and how much can I unnerve or scare you? And he did it all in here still, mm-hmm. but the detail that he was able to make, mm-hmm. that's fantastic.
Yeah, and when we talk about designers, by the way, there are lots of levels and layers to it, because it's like Winston, Baker, Botine, mm-hmm. but then there are tons of guys that work under them and bring a lot of these monsters to life.
Absolutely.
And their own personality, so shout out to all of them as well. I don't want them to go unnoticed, but yeah, I mean, like all of these, do you feel like, I remember reading an article with Ray Harryhausen, who was like, what he wanted to do with every movie was just instill a sense of awe.
Mm. Yeah.
You would watch like those early days, Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, Clash of the Titans and King
just
Kong.
Skeletons wielding swords.
Wielding
man.
Swords.
It's cooler than that.
But that was the thing. That was genuine. I remember watching those. They showed these movies to us in elementary school, like during the holiday breaks and stuff like that. But there was a sense of awe. Do you still feel like that can be achieved today in this kind of VFX age? Or are we kind of too desensitized?
That does feel like the peril, right?
Yeah.
Because I mean, I think downtime being what it is, being able to go back and watch all these old movies and capture that it brings up the same question every time I watch one. How come nothing really catches me the same way necessarily?
Right.
Or it does maybe, but in an altogether maybe kind of possibly uglier way, mm-hmm. which way, you know, because I sort of had to check out at a certain point with like the really hardcore slasher horror, to be honest. Yet I'm into war movies, so it's not over anything
sometimes
other than
we can check out
I
don't know,
that's just, it's almost
tired
too much, you know, when you get into stuff like Saw or whatever, which I've seen and all. But yeah, I do long for that part where the storytelling can kind of, you know, draw you back into the sort of the monster's world and whatever else and give us a chance to like look at that story that way.
I think a lot of studios, it's, you know, VFX and CGI is the cheaper way, but I know it's like me personally and a lot of like my contemporaries who grew up in the 80s on those practical special effects, like are kind of moving back to that and then like using CG to kind of clean up things. Like I was really excited about the movie Antlers. That came out a couple of years ago, and like I believe a
Scott
lot of
Cooper's
that
film, that was great.
Yeah, that monster was practically, practically done, and so it's like, like our generation is going to be the ones that's like, yes, but like let's see if we can do it in camera, and let's get some prosthetics. So yeah, I think there is like a movement back towards practical effects and making your monsters with the latex and whatnot, and just using what we have today to just make it even better and more realistic for this, you know, for our day and age.
Yeah,
Antlers is a good one too. That you know, kind of didn't get as much attention as it should have. And Shane and the Legacy guys created that monster, which looked so freaking terrifying. I think again, the studios, when it comes to money and it comes to making that be like, this is our starting point, or they bake it in knowing this is how we're starting, well, we're just going to do that with that. It's like, please, there's such a difference when an actor reacts to blood actually hitting them in the face than me having to go, someone yelling from off camera, which is fine, it's my imagination, it's what I have to do, and they go, okay, you're getting hit in the face with blood now. Okay, there's something
the
about
same,
getting
right?
hit in the face with blood. There's something about, you know, the reactions that we get, the intangibles, and that's what makes the magic, man. That's what. That's why we love monsters. That's why we love what you do, you know? It's why we love what we do.
Yeah, I think we can still get there, but it is, it does dial back into what you're talking about, which is, I think I remember in the 90s when Jurassic Park came out, everybody got really scared and everybody was like, VFX, man, VFX is gonna take it over. And what we've all, and I can't get into arguments about that anymore, because it's just like, VFX is not gonna take over. We still have a lot of great craftspeople out there who are doing amazing practical work, amazing people in the VFX world, and they gotta hold hands. It's gotta be a handshake.
Yeah.
You know?
No, and that is what Stan Winston would do. It's like Jurassic Park practical models cleaned up and like enhanced with VFX. It's the same thing. It's not a monster, but Iron Man. Yeah. Like it's the practical and the VFX holding hands and like making the experience for the viewer better.
Would you say art is a monster?
Art?
The clown?
Well, that's one of the things that we haven't touched on.
I know,
really?
I was like, wow, we're getting really philosophical, David. It's like, art itself?
Is the self-reflection is a monster?
Yes.
That's
I was
like
wondering, because in that space, those folks, whether you're into that kind of film or not, if you're really like the
fascinated
the
by
buckets
Terrifier.
Of gore, but like, if that's the whoever's watching this, even if that's not your thing, the practical, you know, splatter of and effects of that were
well. I would
something.
Say by Terrifier 2, there's almost something very supernatural about art.
Yeah, which it's kind of hinted at the end of 1.
A little bit, yeah.
And so, yeah, I was like, I guess with the supernatural, you could put him in the same category as Freddy and Jason.
Yeah, but also, I mean, but then when we talk about human monsters, Hannibal Lecter gets, you know, when you go to Michael's during Halloween time and there's those magazines, the Life magazines, the Time magazines that are horror specials.
Oh, yeah, that's
really
bizarre.
I buy them all.
Absolutely. You'll find me holding both the Godzilla special and the Cheers retrospective.
Yes.
But you'll always see Hannibal Lecter roped in, like, just with his mask on, and it's like, that he is genuinely a human monster.
Yeah.
You know? What are some of your own personal favorites out of that realm?
Human monsters?
Yeah.
Or I think when I look back on the, this is based on a true story about a guy who embellished his own story, so it's fictional narrative, and yet based on a true person who actually was monstrous and was, again, mentally ill and super demented. But I think about what the folks who made Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer did to my brain. That to me is a monster. That's a monster because it's because it's not a biopic. It's not like the Jeffrey Dahmer story. It's not because Henry Lee Lucas was lying wildly about the things he did. So the story that unfolds in that narratively is like, it's like an urban legend almost. It's a, there's a mythology to it, although we know he actually did stab and kill and rape people. He's a monster. Yeah. But like, so that to me is, that I don't like, that's not a space I love to like go. It scares the shit out of me. It just really scares me.
Yeah, that's a tough movie to watch too.
I watched it on acid.
Yeah. Oh, God.
Is that on tape?
I did.
That's what's wrong with me.
But I mean, like, Hannibal Lecter kind of goes into that, I wouldn't say necessarily hero space, but we certainly love watching him walk off a plane and go, I'm going to go meet some old friends for dinner, you know?
It's always strikes me because it's, in, especially reading the books, is that, you know, he clearly sees himself as the hero.
Absolutely.
I mean, and the shocking part with all those types of stories that always caught my imagination, I don't know for what bizarre reason, but was the notion that like their view of things is often, it makes more sense in the context of their world than often what I was like, what things I'm dealing with, I could never be as, this guy's like, absolutely has everything laid out. I'm like, nothing in my life is quite that dialed in.
Sure.
And it was like, it was alarming how they seemed more functional in their space, despite the hideousness of what they did. Yeah. But I mean, in that regard, you know.
Such an interesting way to look at it. I never.
I always hesitate to bring that, but I feel like this is the forum to talk that out.
Do you have, I have an envy of the living monsters that we get to watch on our televisions every day who walk around the earth with this confidence of just like, this is what I'm going to do, and this is how I'm going to do it, and I'm going to just scorch the earth in my path. So there is that reality too. That's monstrous to me. Those of us plagued with the gift of, you know, I guess self-awareness, monsters don't, maybe they're devoid of that.
Yeah. The psychological box, once that opens, it's like, well, okay, now you brought everything to table. Yeah, exactly, right?
I'd rather pontificate about Pumpkinhead in his own way as the Faustian bargain you
would
make.
One creates the other, too. I mean, like, you know, we were talking about how, you know, monsters become, you know, we have more compassion for the story or whatever, but like, you know, take something like, say, Jaws, where it's like, well, that never changes. Kind of goes back to your, you know, the man versus nature kind of issue of it, where it's like, man, that monster doesn't have any human thoughts whatsoever, except the ones we're projecting onto him. Mm-hmm. In which case, the film does a great job of, you know, turning him into a character or whatnot.
Right. But or even like going back to one movie that I don't think gets talked about enough, maybe for good reason, is Prophecy.
Oh, wow.
Which is, we are the direct result of this creature being born or you know, maimed, which was a mama bear that, because there are pollutants being thrown into the water, this mama bear has become super gnarly and she stomps around killing summer campers. But then when someone finds her cub, which is also mangled and mutated, she's just after her kid, you know, and that whole movie is just about her chasing the kid. But it's like, she's not the villain here, guys. We are, you know.
You know, before I ever saw that movie, that giant bear effect was sitting out in front of, I think it was XFX on Victory Boulevard in Burbank for the entire time I worked at Toys R Us across the street. I was what on earth is that thing? And it was gigantic. I don't know what it was, possibly for just the scope of size for the shot they were doing, but I was like, that, I don't know what that is. And then years later, I was like, oh, wait, this is what. So it was so interesting connection, but.
I think we covered all the bases. Mm. That was a great conversation.
Indeed.
Yeah. I really appreciate you joining me to talk about movie monsters. It has definitely reignited my love for certain titles that I now want to go and include in my Halloween watch list. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this conversation for the love of monsters.
Again, that was an interview hosted by Ryan Turek with David Dostmalchian, Akela Cooper, and Tom Gilliland. We hope you appreciated this special episode of the Pop Culture Headlines. If you do enjoy this sort of thing, let us know at podcasts@sideshow.com. Don't worry, the regular Pop Culture Headlines will be coming out later today. As always, thanks for listening. And don't forget to let your geek side show.